I am terrible at sermon titles. I remember when I first came to Emmanuel, and Aaron would put the little things in the paper, and he would start asking me, he's like, so what's the title of this one? I'm like, I got nothing. So then we came up with clever sort of things like part one, two, three, four. It's like part 38. I know it's not gripping, but I just never quite. But I did. I have a title. All that, and unfortunately, it just occurred to me last night when I should have been sleeping. Here it is. Didn't have enough time to get it in the paper. It's this: the view from the pit is incomplete. And that's where we're going this morning, because Job is in the pit and fails to see all that God's doing. And some of us, some of you, are perhaps even in one of those seasons, or perhaps in a spot where you can minister to someone who is. And if you are, you need to know that your view is currently not complete. There is more going on than you could ever imagine. I'm going to read from Psalm 40 before we dive in to what Job has for us this morning. David writes this: I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and set my feet on a rock and made my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust. A few verses later, he continues, I have told the glad news of deliverance in the congregation. Behold, I have not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. I have not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and salvation. I have not concealed your steadfastness, your love and faithfulness from the congregation. As for you, O Lord, you will not restrain your mercy from me. Your steadfast love and faithfulness will ever preserve me. For evil has encompassed me, my iniquities have overtaken me, and I cannot see. They're more than the hairs on my head, and my heart fails me. Be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. O Lord, make haste to help me. Let those who be put to shame and disappointed altogether who seek to snatch my life away. Let those be turned back and brought to dishonor who delight my hurt. But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who love your salvation say continually, great is the Lord. As for me, I am poor and needy, but the Lord takes thought of me. We moved to Armstrong almost 20 years ago. And without knowing it, the place we bought, just sort of outside of town, in the north end of town, almost had a view of Armstrong. So you got to kind of picture this little scene so you can get in my head for a moment. We lived, if anyone knows where Circle Square used to be, the ranch up on kind of the hill, that's sort of where we lived. And as I said, we could almost see town, but between us and town, looking down the valley, was this big row of trees. So we knew it was there just over the trees, but you couldn't actually see it. And the other thing we didn't know about Armstrong when we moved there was about this thing called valley cloud, which I think is just fog for us outsiders. And this is not a disparaging thing about Armstrong. It's a lovely community. But living up on the hill, we didn't have it. It was just sort of, we were up above it. And we moved there in the summer, so we hadn't even, like I said, hadn't even given thought to this phenomenon of what might happen come winter. But I do remember the first few mornings this started to happen. I would hop in my vehicle, drive down the hill, because that's sort of down into the community. And as I got about halfway down the hill, you would descend into this thick cloud. And some days, it would stay there all day long. And then at the end of the day, I would hop in my vehicle and I would drive back up the hill. And about halfway back home, come out of the cloud, and it would be like this beautiful sunny day. And sort of as the days and weeks went on, I realized, like, this is just a thing. Like, this is actually. And so there'd be days I'd drive down into work and I'd say to people, it's like, it is a beautiful day, just like literally 5 minutes up the road. And they'd sort of stare at you in disbelief, and we'd live down in the cloud and then drive back. And there were some mornings, it's like driving down, it's like, I don't even want to go there, but it's like, but I should. I really ought to. And I just learned that was sort of the rhythm and kind of an interesting thing. And there'd be days where, you know, I'd come home and, you know, try to explain to Linda. It's like, it was just like foggy all day long. You didn't even see the sun, but up on the hill, it's just this beautiful, lovely thing. And I know some of you know that because even in Vernon, we have the same thing. And I've had people, you know, with me and my, you know, winter blues and seasonal affective, all that good stuff. It's like, just drive up to Silver Star. That'll fix it. I'm like, I get it. There's snow, but there's sun, but there's like all this snow. And like, it's hard to quite figure out, you know, the pros and cons of that thing. Did you know actually it snowed 2 feet in Colorado 2 days ago? That's just a sick, cruel, horrible thing. Anyway, I know some of you love snow and you just don't get it. But anyway, I learned through our years there in Armstrong that there are different perspectives on things. And I'm not, just so you know, I'm not calling Armstrong a pit. But the view from down there, it's not complete. There's more to be seen. And as we work our way through the story of Job, and I hope as you have become familiar with his story, his processing of what is going on in his life, you've at least seen this much. Job's view is far, far from complete. There is so much more going on in his story than he perhaps ever fully realized. And so is yours. There are incredible things that God is doing in and through you, more than you will ever possibly know. In chapter 29, 30, and 31, we have Job's final speech. We've come a long way. And Job's part in all this is coming to an end, but he has one final, last, epic speech that it would be helpful to know. And in the ancient world, Job is actually following a bit of a formula in the ancient world that goes like this. If you feel like someone is suggesting or accusing you of a crime, if they are treating you a certain way because they think you've done something wrong, but they fail to just come right out and say it, you have the right to actually swear an oath, basically saying, I think I'm innocent, and I'm sort of driving a stake in the ground right now, that if I'm guilty, I invite a whole bunch of curses upon me, but today is the day you've got to prove it. Now, you can imagine if you're going to do something like that, you want to be pretty sure that someone doesn't pull out of their back pocket evidence of a whole bunch of wrongdoing. You want to be pretty sure that you were in the right. And I mention that because what Job does through these next three chapters is essentially he has that moment where he gets to the end of all that he said and basically to his friends and even to God says, enough. I know God is just. And I know I've done nothing wrong. Therefore, I'm putting the stake in the ground right here, right now. And if God decides I've done wrong, and we'll see what he says in chapter 31 as he goes through all that, he says, then I ought to be cursed with horrific things happening to me. But I don't think I have. And today is the day I want everyone to know that I'm innocent. Now, that's the quick version. He takes three chapters to get there. Let me just kind of walk you quickly through how he does that. He starts out in chapter 9 by looking back at the good old days. Essentially, the whole chapter is Job reflecting on what life looked like before any of this ever began to take place. And it's actually one of our only few moments where we get a little bit more of sort of the biographical detail of Job. Like, if you kind of want to know, like, what kind of a man was it? I don't know if you're like that when you watch movies and they don't give you much information. The movie ends and you're like, hold on a second. I've got all these questions, like, what happens next and what was it like before? Chapter 29 is a little bit of that sort of thing where we have a picture of who Job was all before this ever took place. And even our only little moment in verse 2 of how long, like, what did this look like from the moment all this went south for Job to this moment, where in chapter 2 we're told, oh, that I were as in the months of old. In other words, Job's saying, like months back, oh, things were different. And we don't know weeks, months, how long time Job is pointing to. But we do get a little bit of a glimpse of what that looked like. Look at some of the things he says. Verse 3, when his lamp shone upon my head, in other words, God watching over it, it was like God shone upon me. And by his light I walked through darkness. I was in my prime when the friendship of God was upon my tent. Job's like, I was just at the height of life. God literally shone upon me. The Almighty was yet with me. My children were all around me. Then verse 6, when my steps were washed with butter. Now I'm going, there's some odd references in Job, right? It's like, what on earth is he talking about? And the rocks poured out streams of oil. This is Job just using word pictures to describe how good it was. In other words, a couple things going on. He points to two of the kind of unique, valuable food-type commodities. If you remember the story of Israel coming into the promised land, the nation, it's often described as a land flowing with milk and honey. Like two wonderful foods in the ancient world. Like if you didn't have chocolate, right? That's how I always related. Like you didn't have refined sugar. You didn't just go to the store and buy a box of nice cookies. Like honey was it. That was the one sweet thing. So you've got this land flowing. Job's doing something similar. You want something that is rich and wonderful. Not only that, but that is incredibly useful. Like Job's kind of like, to me, sort of like an off-the-grid guy here. He's like streams of oil. So you used oil to heat your house, to light your house, to cook. It was like one of the essential things. Olive oil was like an essential thing for life. And Job's saying, I remember the day when there was just so much of it. It's like, it was like we just like walked through it. It just was like everywhere. Butter and oil and all this goodness all around me. And Job's looking back to these days and going, oh, there was a day when life was so good. There's all these great pictures he provides for us. I went out to the gate in verse 7, gate of the city, and I prepared my seat in the square. In other words, this is a place where the leaders of a town would come, and he said, and the young man saw me and withdrew. The aged rose and stood. Princes refined from time. In other words, Job's saying, I remember back in those days, I had a spot of honor. But I said, mattered. I had a place of influence. By the end of the chapter, actually, if you look at the very last verse, verse 25, I chose their way and sat as a chief. I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. Job's saying, you know what? There was not a spot in the community where I wasn't serving and involved. In times of peace, I was there like a counselor. In times of conflict, I was the one that was there to care for people around me. Even when people were brokenhearted, I was there to care for them. That's what life used to be like. And between those things, he goes through all these incredible descriptions of how he lived, of how he used his influence. Talks in verse 12 of how he delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had no one to help them. In other words, he says, you know what? When I arrived at the top, when I was the guy, all the flocks, all the herds, all the stuff, all the employees, I didn't step back and say, you know what? I am a self-made man. I produced this, and so now I will enjoy it all for my exclusive privilege and enjoyment. Job says, actually, you know what? When I finally got to that spot, I took it all and I served others. Incredible, incredible generosity. I was the eyes to the blind. I was the feet to the lame. I was the father to the needy. I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know. There's people in need. I didn't even know them. But I took it upon myself to care for them and to pursue justice. And I thought, verse 18, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. I thought it would just always be like this. I thought I would grow old, and there in my home with my family around me, that's when I would breathe my last. A full, right, happy, productive life that had benefited all those around me. He said, that's what I thought it was going to look like. chapter 30. But now, Job said it didn't stay that way. And it's probably worth for us just remembering a couple things. It's hard to know with these chapters how much Job is correct in his observation and how much he's in danger with some of what he's doing here. Because there can be a danger of looking with incredible, sort of an absolutized sense of the good old days. You've maybe run into people who have kind of slipped maybe into the dangerous side of that, when everything in the past just was good, and they sort of sanitize all the hard parts out of it, and they just look back, it's like, oh man, if only we could go back to the good old days, the way it used to be, because it was so, so good. I'm not sure if Job's stepped into that dangerous spot yet, but we can, and it's worth being careful with that. Couple other things that I think are worth just being aware of just along the way. In addition to the good old days not always being as good as we remember, never mistake the blessing of life. Never mistake chapter 29 moments for God's stamp of approval. I think that's the problem of Job's friends. In their minds, it's such a clear thing. If it looks like that, then God is approving of you. And if it looks anything different, then he's disapproving your life. And I think Job's wrestled with that all through the story up to now. But don't mistake that on either side. Right? There's a danger on either side of going, hey, you know what? Everything's good. God must be approving. Or everything's difficult. God must be judging. There's so much more to that question than just the circumstance and how many sheep are living in your front yard. Lastly, before we move on, things will not always stay the same. And that will hold true in chapter 30 with the hard things, but it also, I think, holds true a little bit sometimes with the good things. And it's worth just realizing that, reminding ourselves that that's part of life. Things don't always stay the same. In fact, I remember once hearing someone explain sort of the prosperity of the Western world, and it was in the context of most of us think, you know, what we have, we've worked really hard for. And his whole point was this, essentially, the vast, vast majority of what we have has nothing to do with us. You were born at a certain point in history to a certain family with certain educational privileges. Had you been born in a different country, in a different place, maybe some of you have thought this, if I was born on the other side of the earth, or if I was born 100 years ago and not how, right? And it's just that realization that most of what we have is purely gift. And hopefully that shapes how we hold it. It seems to have for Job, to his credit. Hopefully it will to us. But then, Job says, now they laugh at me. Which is an interesting choice of words, because right near the end of chapter 29, he actually uses the exact same word. In chapter 29, it's translated as smile. In other words, I smiled at the world around me, and they smiled back at me. And it sounds so good in chapter 29, but now in chapter 30, it's just translated in this mocking sense, because Job says, now when they look at me, it's not this smile. Now it's a look of mockery. In fact, he says, my name has become a byword a few verses later. In other words, what he's saying is this. Things went so horrifically wrong that to be a Job, that's what he's saying. You know how people use language that way? Like, to be a Job was to be a guy who had lost the favor of God, who was cursed by God, who probably claimed to be innocent, but we all knew he wasn't. That his name became associated with that. And even the young men who used to sort of defer to him, now they mock him. And they turn on him in disgust. He said, people who prior to this, as he talks about in verse 1, they're younger than I, their fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. He said, I would not have even hired them to work with the dogs who worked with my sheep. And now they sit in mockery and judgment on me. Now be careful. Job is not saying I'm mocking a whole category of people. Job's looking and saying, you remember those, it's going to give you a little insight into my high school years. That's why when Tyler said it's like the best is to come, I'm like, oh, praise the Lord, couldn't pay me enough to go back. But remember those people who just all came easy? And they were like, plug your ears, teachers. They were like clearly the teacher's pet. And those of us who were like working hard and like trying and knew the shenanigans they were pulling as soon as the teacher walked out of the room, and yet everything went so well, and you're going, you've got to be kidding. Remember, I had this one teacher, it was like grade 12 math, who decided it'd be a great thing. I was okay at math. So we paired the top student with the worst student in the class, and then all the way down, and I was sort of up on that end at that point. And then he averaged our grades. So like, I got the grade, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Right? And Job's looking at those kind of people and saying, it's not that I'm judging a whole segment of population. He's like, these people were just, they were just good for nothing. They brought it on themselves. And now those very people that had life handed to them and just wasted it, they look on me and laugh and mock, make me the butt of jokes. It goes on through this whole thing. Verse 10, they abhor me. They keep aloof of me, and they don't even hesitate to spit at the sight of me. Literally, what he's saying is, they don't even hesitate to spit on me. It's not like they see Job and go, hup. It's like, no, they see Job and go, pff. They don't have to think twice. He's that much an object of scorn and ridicule. And he just goes through this whole chapter. And even God, as he gets to the end, I cried for help, verse 20, and you don't answer me. I stand and you only look at me. You've turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. Verse 22 is an interesting. You lift me up on the wind. Isn't that like a beautiful thing? It's like, if this was a psalm, we'd be going, oh, this is a good one. Like, this is like an expression of how God saves his people. God, like, lifts me up on the wind, Job says. He does all that. Makes me ride on it. Just to toss me about in the roar of the storm. It's not like a great. Like, you lift me up, but then you get me there, and it's like, I'm going to give you the ride of your life, Job. Job said, used to be all so good, and now there's nothing left. Now, there's some things that we need to consider here in this chapter, too, because if there's a way we can absolutize the past and make the good old days nothing but good and just forget all the other pieces, there's also a way we can do that in hard days, isn't there? Where we go through hard things and just sort of lose sight of any goodness around us. We forget the pieces of our life that are still wonderfully good because all we see is the pain and the difficulty that we're going through. Job gets to this point in verse 31. My lyre is tuned to mourning and my pipe to the voice of those who weep. That's a weird reference. You have to go back 4,000 years ago to have even a clue what he's talking about, because there wasn't standardized instrument tuning 4,000 years ago. In other words, had we got the band together, right, and the piano's tuned and the guitar and everything sounds good together, well, 4,000 years ago, it didn't work like that, right? Everything was tuned individually. And so you would tune an instrument to the type of music it was going to produce. And so through the Psalms, we often see these little musical notations, you know, to the tune of, or, you know, according to the instruction of. Most likely what we're reading is actually sort of the tuning instructions to an instrument. So if you're going to play sort of a song of mourning, it sounds what we might describe as sort of like a minor sort of sound. Job just says here, here's all I've got. If you would compare me to a lyre, I can only do mourning. I got one tune to play. I can't look around and see anything good anymore. It's just all that. When you are there, be careful not to neglect the other parts of life. Well, there are hard things that come. Many of you are living them and experiencing them even right now. But outside, beyond those hard things, there are good things. And we need to work hard to not tune our song just to mourning, but to remember, hey, there's glimmers of goodness around me. Chapter 31. Job's looked at the past, he's looked at his present. And now chapter 31 is going to be a very interesting chapter. That Job does something majestic with, okay? I should have brought up my whiteboard. I maybe will for second service. So my apologies, because I forgot it. I'll try to describe what he's done here, okay? Verse 1 to 3, he describes the formation of a covenant. Verse, 4 to 6, he issues a challenge. Verse 7 to 34, he catalogs his covenant faithfulness. Then verse 35 to 37, he repeats the challenge. And verse 38 to 40, he attests to his faithfulness to the covenant. So if you're kind of looking at how the whole chapter is structured, it's like he starts and ends with the same idea. The second idea and the third idea kind of support each other. And in the middle is the bulk of the chapter. So really he's saying, as he does in verse 31, I have made a covenant. Like, make sure you just see what he says. I've made a covenant. That's what we might sort of describe as sort of like a contractual agreement, but it's way more, there's more depth to it. We can just put it that way. I've made a covenant. And he goes on and he describes this covenant he's made. Oftentimes people just grabbed a hold of little bits of this chapter and kind of go, here's a great verse. Every guy should read verse 31, you know, chapter 31, verse 1. Which is a great verse. Jesus says, you know what? I've made a covenant with my eyes. How could I then gaze at a virgin? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? Is not calamity for the unrighteous and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does not he see my ways and number all my steps? Great question. Job just says here, I made a covenant with God. Here's some of the pieces of the covenant. And do I not think if I was to break this covenant that disaster would come, that God would see, he would know? That's kind of the questions he's asking. And in Job's mind, the answer is absolutely yes. If I was just to break the covenant I made before the Lord, things would go horrifically awry. But, Job's going to say, I didn't. It's the essential message of the chapter. I didn't. And he catalogs then all of the possible sins that someone might imagine, perhaps his friends might imagine, that he has committed. Look at how he does it. If, verse 5, I walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. If my step turned aside from the way and my heart went after my eyes, if any spot has stuck to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. And let what grows for me be rooted out. You hear kind of how he's doing this? He's saying, here's something that should not be done. Man or woman should not speak falsely. You and I should not allow our hearts to pursue the things that our eyes see. In other words, Job's saying, you know what? There's probably a day where he looked at the farm next door and they had the latest piece of equipment and his eyes saw it. And he said, but I wouldn't let my heart go there. Had it, here's the curse I would invite on myself, that I would sow, verse 8, and another would eat. That what had grown would be rooted out. Now he goes through a whole series of these sort of things. I'm not going to go through each individually, but you can kind of start to see them. Verse 9 to verse 12. If my heart had been enticed to a woman, or if a woman had been writing this, you know, to a man. If I'd lain in wait at my neighbor's door. And he goes on and describes what he hopes would be the punishment for that. In other words, Job's saying, had I done all these things, my life should have been destroyed. On and on he goes. If I rejected the cause of my manservant or maidservant, they brought a complaint against me. What then shall I do when God rises up, when he makes inquiry? What shall I answer to him? And Job just kind of goes through all these things. Adultery, if I had mistreated people, if I had been deceitful. If I'd made gold my trust, verse 24. So in other words, Job said, if I had put my hope in stuff, then I ought to have been punished. There ought to have been a right consequence. But you hear what's going on behind the scenes, right? Because you and I both know, if you know the story of Job, this is what's happened to him. His life has been laid to waste. And Job's really puzzled. He's essentially saying, God, it would appear to me that I'm suffering the consequence of a whole lot of things that I didn't do. I kept the covenant. And that's sort of the force of the whole chapter. So by the time we get down to the end in verse 35, here's what he says. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had an indictment written by my adversary. I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me as a crown. Job's sort of laying his case out and saying, I'm going to sign my signature to this thing. And I want God to write me a document that says, innocent. He said, I would wear it like a crown. That would be the one thing I long to see happen. Now, kind of go there because he isn't quite finished. You would think that would be a great spot for the chapter to end. Verse 37, I would give an account of all of my steps. But Job doesn't. He's got one last thing, and this is the important piece of this covenant. Verse 38, if my land has cried out against me and its furrows have wept together, if I've eaten its yield without payment and made its owners breathe their last, let thorns grow instead of wheat and foul weeds instead of barley, the words of Job are ended. And we all say, woohoo, we made it. The book's not done, but probably some of you feel a little bit of relief that Job's words have come to an end because they're tough. Now, let me just explain what he did in the last three verses for those of us who kind of read it and go, that's a really strange way to end this incredibly epic speech before God. Talked about his former life, talked about his present life, made a covenant before God, made this incredible statement of, and here I sign my signature. I want God to proclaim me innocent. And then it feels like right at the end, it's like, oh, I forgot one thing. Had the land cried out against me, then I hope it all just grows with weeds and thorns. All right. Okay, that's it. Done. Why does he end with those three verses, in other words? It's not a thoughtless add-on. It's Job's way of saying, the covenant I've just made with God, it's been attested to. All through the Old Testament, you'll see it very, very frequently that the land, it gets tied in with the issue of covenant. In other words, this is God's world. It's kind of what Job's arguing. And the one thing you can't overcome is what the land does. The land's going to attest to whether Israel is faithful or not. And in the end, if you read through the argument of the prophet, so much of the consequence and the judgment of the nation of Israel has to do with the land itself. It's God's way of saying, I will indicate to you what I think by what happens in the land. And Job gets to the end of his covenant. He says, I've made a covenant with God. I've given all the evidence. And I believe the land shows that I haven't broken it, that I'm in the right. And that's why I end my words there. Whoa. Someone should have been waving by now. Then I'll end here with this thought. I don't mean like right here. I mean like just a couple minutes. As Job comes to an end, let me say to you what I wish I could say to him. Job, there is so much more going on than you know. You see this much. Oh, you saw what happened before. You see what's happening now. You come before God and say, I'm confused. Essentially, isn't that what chapter 31 is about? It's like, God, I'm confused. I don't understand how this works. Job, there is so much more going on than you could possibly realize. And the verse I would point you to, and here's the verse I want to end with, is in John chapter 5, verse 17. It's a long, great chapter, by the way, that ends with Jesus making this statement. My Father is working until now, and I am working. Now, rich, rich statement all about Sabbath and all what is going on there and who he's claiming to be. He's essentially claiming to be God. I just love the part of Jesus saying, my Father is working. And here's why I love it. Because literally what it means is, my Father is always working. It's never stopped. In the old King James, it's like the word hitherto shows up. Isn't that a great word? It's like, hitherto. Okay, what's going on? What does this mean? There's actually some wonderful words. The word working actually means to labor, to work hard. Like God is working hard at some stuff. When? That's the critical thing. Is there a time in Job's life or yours when God has stopped working? Isn't that an important question? Because isn't that how it feels? It's like, I'm doing my part, God. Why aren't you doing yours? It seems like you've stopped working. Jesus answers it for us with a brilliant word. It's actually a combined word. He takes an adverb of continuance, which means like as far as, whenever, always, that kind of thing. And then he adds it to another adverb that means this day or even now, that produces a word that just means God's always been doing it this day and forevermore. Here's what you need to know if you're in the pit. You might not see God at work, but he has always been, currently is, and forevermore will be working. And when Job says back in chapter 23, on my left hand when he is working, I do not see him, that is as true for you as it was for him. You might not see him today, but there is more going on than you can possibly imagine in the pit, in those hard moments. God's at work. Trust him.